Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Serious childhood illnesses, it's not just about the child, it's about the family, it's about everybody. Misty Crane has been the medical reporter at the Columbus Dispatch for 11 years, and prior to that, she covered state politics for Thompson Newspapers. Her two-part series, Lily's Story, on focused on the life of 7-year-old Lily Decker, who lives with a brain tumor, and inspired the show today. Welcome to the show, Misty.
Thanks, Ann. Nice to be here.
Also, Erica Decker, she's the mother of Lily Decker and a private chef. She owns her own business called Decker and Decker Cuisine, and she took the time to join us today as well. Welcome to the show, Erica.
Thanks. Good morning, Ann.
So for our listeners, we're talking about childhood cancer, but serious childhood illness as well. So has your child had cancer? Has your child had a serious illness? Does your child live with a serious illness? And did you get the medical and emotional support that you needed during the process and throughout the process? And maybe it's an ongoing process. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. And you know, you can go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page whenever you want. Post your question or comment there. Misty, why a story about a child with cancer? Why now?
Well, actually, the story idea came about when we found out that Flying Horse Farms was going to open up. And so Flying Horse is a camp that is for children with all kinds of serious illnesses, one of those being cancer. And Chris Russell, a photographer, came to me with the idea, actually, and said, I would love to find some child to tell this story through. So it wasn't just the story of camp, but the story of why camp is so important. And that's really where the idea came from. And we got to work trying to find the right family to tell that story.
You know, a lot of people have always asked me when I was in the newspaper business, and they do even still with the show, is how do you find the people that you write about? So how do you go about finding someone like Lily Decker?
Well, the folks at Flying Horse were very helpful in that regard. They knew the Decker family from a family camp that they had earlier in the year, and they introduced us. And then we started from there. Chris and I went and met them and tried to figure out if they were willing to let us do this. And That was really it. I mean, it was a good fit from the beginning, I think.
Erica case. Decker, so when someone comes to you with a question like that, in amid all of the other stuff you're going through, what did you think?
Well, when Misty first called, she was so nice on the phone. I just connected with her right away. But then when they came to the house to see if this would work, about 3 hours later, Lily finally stopped talking. And I think they knew they had someone that they could really build a story around. Lily's very open. She always has been. Even in the worst of times, she's got a story to tell. And to be honest with you, when we first started down this journey, when she was 4 and being diagnosed with a brain tumor that's inoperable, we didn't know anyone that had been through this. We didn't know what the picture would look like for us for the next several years. And we thought, if this helps any family to know what they're facing, then this is worth doing.
Misty, you've been covering medical stories for 11 years now for the Dispatch. How does a child's experience, from where you sit, how does it differ from an adult's experience with a serious illness?
The thing I've noticed, I've covered a lot of stories that involve children with illnesses, pediatric cancer to a certain extent, but other things too. And it seems, to me, it seems different in that they don't go into it with expectations. They don't have... They haven't known somebody necessarily who's been sick. They don't know what death is, you know. And so they learn about it as they go. And often what I've noticed is these children are very, very mature, very wise beyond their years. They interact with adults really well, and they enjoy life. They have an appreciation that I think some kids aren't forced to have.
Yeah, Lily was diagnosed when she was 4 years old, so she's pretty much grown up mm-hmm. with this. And do you in the story, the point is made that she does interact with adults very easily and very well. And I was wondering if you had any sense about whether that was ingrained in her beforehand or whether that is a function of being seriously ill.
It's hard to say at this point because she was 4 right. And she's never known any different. Her longest memories go back to when she was diagnosed, so it's always been there for her. And I've always told people that being a child has actually worked for her. She knows nothing different. She, like Misty said, she has no expectations other than what is happening this week. And they're busy. They have things to do. She's got friends to play with, and she's got TV to watch, and she's got toys. So it's not in her way. I think Lily's extraordinary as a child anyway, but she is definitely drawn to adults because I think, sadly, she has very little in common with a lot of her friends at this point. She just finished treatment. So, I mean, it's been very involved. I'm hoping as we get some distance between the last year of chemotherapy and now that she will acclimate back into a child's world a little bit more. But she's not unhappy. She's an extremely happy child. She wakes up laughing. And so I think kids have the advantage of not knowing any different. I think it would be very different for her if she was a teenager, if she knew what she was missing, if she knew what was really ahead, possibly. But she doesn't. And so in that way, and we've never hid anything from her. We made that decision very early on that we would be not morbidly honest, but just honest, because if you're not, they know it. And then they don't trust you.
I wanted to talk to you about that. But first, to let people know that coming up later in the program, we're going to have Cindy Lazarus on. She's the CEO of Flying Horse Farms. It's permanent year-round camp for children with serious illnesses. And that's what we were just talking about a few minutes ago. Joining me right now, Erica Decker. She's the mother of Lily Decker. Lily is highlighted in a beautiful story written by Misty Crane of the Columbus Dispatch. Misty just rolled her eyes. But it's true. It's all true. How did you decide, though, to be, I know, not morbidly honest, but to talk about it openly with her?
Well,
because she was 4 years old. Did you do it immediately?
Well, she knew it was terrible. They shaved her head, and she had brain surgery at four. I mean, they're aware. They know something's really wrong. And in those first... Well, especially the first week, you know, your child looks at your face. They can read the world through your expression. And if you don't give them a reason why your face looks like that, they can make one up on their own. Right. And you don't want that. You want them to know exactly what's going on. And so we developed a system, too, in the very beginning and we based it on Children's Hospital, a system of 1 to 10, how you're feeling. So when we would face a procedure or a test or an appointment, she would say, okay, Mom, 1 to 10, how bad? And I would tell her the exact truth. And as soon as she had the information, she let it go. She just wanted to know.
There was probably some stuff that she could tell you that you couldn't tell her if it was going to be a 1 to 10. You know the issue about the portal.
Right.
Very uncomfortable. And I interviewed a Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer a couple weeks ago who documented his cancer treatments and in a film documentary. And he talked about that portal a lot, and it made me much more sensitive to that part of the story about how irritating, and it's irritating in an inexplicable way.
Right. It's invasive, mentally and physically, for her. She doesn't like her port. I've called the practitioner three times since we finished treatment to see when we could schedule the removal, and each time she says, be patient. We like to get a little more, a few more stable MRIs.
So you don't have to stick another one in.
Right.
Right.
But I'm really working hard to help her. It was sad to me. Lily loved nothing more than swimming before we got started in chemo, and then one of the bad things about chemo is you can't be in fresh water, so she couldn't swim, and when she would swim, her port would show and her scars. She still has a lot of scars. And she became very self-conscious, and that broke my heart, that she was worried about how other people viewed her body at seven. And so I'm anxious for that to be out for her.
Misty Crane, how much time do you have to spend with the family, or do you like to spend with the family to do this sort of a treatment on an issue?
Well, it kind of depends on the story. I've spent as long as eight or 9 months drifting in and out of somebody's life to try to tell a story like this. In this case, I think we knew each other for a couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
It came together quite quickly, and it was a time in the Deckers' life when they were going through a lot. So Chris and I were able to experience a lot of the medical side of Lily's life with her in the 2 months leading up to her week at the camp. And then we spent much of that whole week that she was at the camp with her, which gave us a real, you know, that was great. That was a terrific opportunity to see her interact with children and other people and be outside of the hospital setting. So, you know, we spent we spent a fair amount of time, but, you know, we weren't over at their house every day or anything.
I love this, the scene in the story where you're dropping her off at the camp and you say, geez, you want us to hang around with you for a little while?
Oh, like, I knew what the answer was going to
yeah.
be.
being polite and asking.
Right. I don't know. You see all the doting parents and everyone all hugging, and Lily's gone. As soon as we got out of the car, she was 100 feet ahead of us, and I don't think I saw her again until we said goodbye.
You had to look for her to say goodbye.
But I've always loved that. That's one of my proudest moments as a mom, is to know how self-assured she is and how confident and how comfortable she is among people, especially hundreds that she doesn't know. But it's a nightmare at fairs, and we did a cancer walk last weekend, and she just went flying off into downtown amongst hundreds of walkers, and she's fearless. She's absolutely fearless.
The how her cancer was discovered, you hear these stories all the time. It's completely unrelated thing happened. Can you tell us how it was discovered when she was 4 years old? It wasn't a series of symptoms that began to emerge.
No symptoms. Just being four and jumping from the couch to the ottoman, couch, ottoman, and in the last time that I screamed, Lily, stop, she took a dive headfirst onto the wood floor, and it was one of those silent screams for minutes where you know it's really bad. So we got her calmed down, and she was fine the rest of the evening, but the next day started vomiting, had a headache, was dizzy, was walking funny. And so we took her to the pediatrician. He said, let's get a CAT scan just to be sure. And I'm so grateful to him that he did that, because she wasn't even symptomatic still at that point of anything.
It could
really
have been
wrong.
A concussion.
Right. Yeah. And so we went to Children's, had the CAT scan before we made it back to the parking garage. They called on our cell phone and said, there's a neurosurgeon waiting to talk to you. And we just looked at each other, and I'll never forget that moment. And we didn't leave. By the time we went from the parking garage to the neurosurgeons, they had scans of her brain all across the wall, and they were asking very strange questions. Did she reach her milestones on time? Let me see her walk. Can she jump? Grab my fingers. It was just all happening so fast. They were asking me.
But when you just looked at them, they didn't mean anything to you.
I've never seen a brain scan
in my life.
I don't
even know what they're looking at half the time.
But now I look at those scans and I think, oh, my God. The whole left side of her brain was completely engulfed in fluid, which isn't healthy.
Which was caused by the bump on her head.
It's caused by a blockage in her ventricle, which was the tumor.
Okay, so what did the bump do when she
fell on
the floor?
The bump increased the pressure just enough to make the fluid pressure increase just enough to have symptoms of a concussion, but they're also symptoms of tumor.
Her doctor told me they couldn't believe that she had been asymptomatic up to that point. When you look at the scans, and he showed them to me, it's incredible what was going on inside, and no symptoms at all until that day.
Well, that's the other frustration with children, is they don't know if something's wrong. So they may live with something and not be able to not bother to even tell you about it.
Right. I think the theory behind what happened to Lily is that tumor was existing when she was born, and it has grown so slowly and in spurts probably that her brain has just accommodated. Every time the pressure increased, every time the fluid increased, the brain just adapted, which is what is terrific about the brain. But it finally had gotten to the point, and we're so grateful that they found it. And I kind of am grateful that she doesn't listen to me and she fell on the floor. And and she'll be the first to point out, see, it's good.
Uh-oh.
Right.
She did undergo several rounds of chemotherapy.
A full 48-week course. We almost finished. She had to quit at the very end because of allergic reactions to the main drug. And it wasn't a surprise. They knew it would happen. They just didn't know when. So we were happy that she got all the way almost to the end, but it happened a week before the MRI, which would tell us if we could quit. So that was really uncomfortable.
And they said you could.
Yeah.
It was successful, mm-hmm. and that's why she got to go to Flying Horse Farms. Coming up, we are going to hear from Dr. Mark Rinaldi. He's a hematology, oncology, bone marrow transplant doctor at Nationwide Children's Hospital. Misty Crane of the Dispatch and Erica Decker, the mother of Lily Decker, the subject of Missy's story. They'll stay with us as well, so I hope you do too. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Previously on Car Talk.
Whenever someone comes up with this strange little cures, either the person is a genius or a complete wacko.
And right now, you're right on the fence.
I'm leaning toward wacko now.
Well, there's a very fine line.
There is.
There
may not be any line.
Right. You may have crossed back and forth three or four times already.
Join us for more keen yet sensitive analysis this week on Car Talk.
And Car Talk begins at noon tomorrow on 89.7 NPR News. 42 degrees with partly sunny skies. Expect sunshine throughout the day and a high right around 52 degrees. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 34. Mostly sunny for Saturday, a high of 44 degrees. Some clouds Saturday night, cooling off to a low of 28. And then partly sunny on Sunday and warming back up to a high of 40.
Support for 89.7 comes from the estate of Donald R. Glancy, whose life was enriched by public radio and television, and whose bequest seeks to encourage others to discover WOSU Public Media.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Still with us, Misty Crane of the Columbus Dispatch. Her two-part story, then Lily Decker, shed light on the experiences of a child with cancer and also a special camp for children with serious illnesses, Flying Horse Farms. We'll learn about that later on with Cindy Lazarus. She's CEO of Flying Horse Farms, permanent year-round camp for children with serious illnesses. And also with us, Erica Decker, Lily's mom. Joining us now, Dr. Mark Ranalli. He is a hematology, oncology, bone marrow transplant doctor at Nationwide Children's Hospital. He's also an associate professor of clinical pediatrics at the OSU College of Medicine, and he is medical director of the Comprehensive Hemoglobinopathy Center at Nationwide Children's and oversees the embryonal tumor program.
Did I get that right?
Could somebody testify for me? Dr. Ranalli, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Part of your job as a pediatric physician is not only communicating with the patient, but also with the patient's parents. And Erica made a comment in Misty's story. She said, I thought it was a thorough science. I thought it was exact, but it's anything but.
I think that's a very astute comment, and I think it's something that shocks most families when they come to their doctor for any reason and for any specialty. You know, there are some fundamental things that we do, but ultimately there are nuances, and every child's going to be an individual and individualized, and you have to tailor your approach, your discussions, your therapy to what that patient happens to be doing. I think it can be very frustrating for families sometimes, because oftentimes in any specialty you have to adopt a wait and see sort of approach at times, because you've taken the therapy as far as you need to take the therapy, and then you need to allow that patient to heal and to kind of declare themselves in terms of how they're going to recover, how they're going to respond.
And there's also that impulse to say, how are you going to fix this? And there's the response is, well, no, you have to learn how to live with this.
I think in certain situations that's true. A tumor like Lily's, which is a very slow-growing kind of tumor, and I think her mom very well accurately described it in terms of having spurts of growth, some of these things are more predictable than other things, and in certain situations, a cancer diagnosis is more of a chronic health disorder where patients learn to live with it. There are other disorders, and quite frankly, the majority of cancer diagnoses that we treat, the leukemias, those sorts of things, that are actually curable probably 80% of the time.
Can you tell us about the incidence of childhood cancer? How rare was Lily's form? Is Lily's form of cancer? And also, you said leukemia is the most common.
Right. You know, pediatric cancer in general is a fairly rare clinical entity. There's only about 12,000, between 12 and 13,000 cases per year in the U.S. That's maybe 2 per 10,000 children. And if you think about it, the incidence of breast cancer is 1 in 8 to 1 in 10 women. So there's a dramatic difference in terms of frequency. And as you break a cancer diagnosis down to the different types of diagnoses, the leukemias, the brain tumors, and then the subtypes of brain tumors, they become exceedingly rare. So it's important for these children to be seen at large hospitals like Nationwide Children's that see a larger number of cancer patients, because you have more experience. The more experience you have in a rare disorder, the more adept you are at treating it and understanding its idiosyncrasies and its nuances.
Has the incidence rate, the rate of it, been pretty stable over time as long as it's been looked at? Or has there been an increase?
There's been a marginal increase, I think offset by kind of improvements in cures related largely to both improvements in supportive care and really research into new treatments.
Now, because of the low frequency, that must affect the ability to study it in children.
It does, and I think what many families don't really appreciate is pediatric oncology, pediatric cancer therapy is a pretty uniform science. And so if you're in Columbus, if you're in Los Angeles, if you're in Miami, we're going to approach you the same way because we try to treat everybody with a given diagnosis in kind of a collaborative way. Most pediatric hospitals that treat children with cancer are part of a cancer consortium called the Children's Oncology Group. And the whole goal of that is to basically treat everybody with a given diagnosis in a uniform way. So you can move through clinical trials quickly, discover which therapies work best, and then begin to incorporate new ideas and new medications into therapies more quickly.
So are there new advances in treating children with cancer that have made a big difference, or has it been steady Eddie as she goes and nothing really outstanding has changed?
You know, it's in general, it's a gradual and kind of incremental improvement. And you have to look at it in two ways. There are clearly new drugs, new agents that we're beginning to actually target specific cancers. We know certain cancers have very specific molecular and genetic fingerprints, and there are new agents now that actually specifically go after those fingerprints or those abnormalities that we think are actually the causal or the causative abnormality. And in that sense, we're getting better at kind of individualizing and targeting therapy for patients. The other aspect of that is the whole notion of supportive care. When children used to have bad outcomes with cancer, it oftentimes wasn't the cancer that actually killed them. It was the infections or the blood count problems that they would encounter. And really, over the past 10 or 20 years, there have been dramatic improvements in terms of with respect to supportive care and how we get kids through the anticipated complications that they have when they receive the kind of chemotherapy and the kind of therapies we give.
What about treating children, the issue of treating children who may not be as good of a reporter as an adult might be about their condition and what they're feeling? Maybe I'm wrong about that, but I'm just wondering.
No, you know, I think as a pediatrician, you learn to regardless of your pediatric specialty, you learn to kind of read the cues. Children, quite frankly, are better than many adults in certain respects at being straightforward with you and honest about how they're feeling and what's going on. But in general, it's a combination of hearing what they say, respecting what the parents are telling you because the parents are watching them every day. And if someone comes to you with a complaint that's a recurrent or a persisting complaint, as a physician, you need to be very nervous about that. And then respecting the cues that the patient's giving you that may not be directly verbal, you know, if they're not eating well or if they're just being more lethargic or those sorts of things. It's really a combination of features that you have to kind of pull together.
My guest is Dr. Mark Ranalli. He's a hematology, oncology, bone marrow transplant doctor at Nationwide Children's Hospital. If you have a question or comment for him, we welcome them. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about childhood cancer today, and it was inspired by a couple of stories, a two-story package that Misty Crane did for the Columbus Dispatch. If you're familiar with those stories, you know what we're talking about. Lily Decker and her mother is with us today as well, Erica Decker and also Misty Crane. So if you have a question or comment for anybody, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Dr. Ranalli, in Misty's stories about Lily, she quoted a physician at Cleveland's Rainbow Babies and Children's Hospital who he said he wants to see oncologists, especially young ones, take advantage of opportunities to interact with patients outside the clinic. I was wondering, do you agree with that?
Absolutely. You know, and you're going to be talking to folks from Flying Horse Farm, mm-hmm. Those sorts of organizations. The whole notion of seeing kids outside the clinic, I think, is a very important facet of what we do, and most of us here are involved in some fashion or another with outside organizations. It's important for, I think, physicians to understand that I think all a kid wants to do is to be a kid, and providing them with that sense of normalcy is a huge weapon for you in terms of combating the disease, making the kids more compliant, making them more resilient, and putting the families more at ease. You know, organizations like Flying Horse Farms, what Make-A-Wish does, what Mason Woods Foundation does, a number of these organizations in the city, they provide that normalcy for these kids. And it's really rewarding for us to sort of see kids when they're actually not getting poked and prodded. It kind of gives us that motivation to kind of keep doing what is otherwise a very difficult job to do.
And he also said especially young oncologists. Why not older ones, too? What's the diff?
I think it has to do with the way training has changed over time, and we've become much more reliant on necessarily on technology, scans, molecular studies, those sorts of modalities that improve cures and allow us to understand disease better, but you become very immersed in that, and you have to, and you swim in that soup, and you really forget that there's a patient under the sheets sometimes, or it's very easy to overlook the fact that you have a little kid under the sheets, and that that little kid likes to play ball, likes to ride horses, likes to play video games or do the things that kids do. And I think you can relate much more to children when you can understand them from that aspect. I think the older generation of physicians who may not have been trained in that sort of an environment, I think are a little more appreciative of that, the influence of that kind of normal environment that these kids have on their health.
Is it pretty part of the regular training now for pediatricians and pediatric specialists to have, you know, to understand that part of it?
I think it's a small aspect of it. I think most medical schools are getting better at that. I think there's a little bit of work to do in that realm, because it's a very, very important part of what we do. I think it makes us more approachable to families, and it makes us understand their plight a lot better.
Erica Decker, from where you sit, what was it like to have, when the doctors got to know Lily versus those early diagnoses, the early diagnosis in those early days?
Well, the original neurosurgeon that helped Lily was terrific. He loved children, and it really came through, and he really took to Lily right away. When we moved into the oncology section, I was a little taken aback by the seriousness of the physician that we had, who today I adore. But then I finally realized,
you have to get to someone you had to get to know. Right?
I couldn't make him laugh. We couldn't. There was just, it seemed so serious, and I thought, gosh. But then I realized, hey, I think I want him really serious. I think I'm not, you know, I don't need to have him be the super feel-good guy. I can get that from lots of places. I was very comfortable with the fact that he was very serious in a scientific way. The care we received at Nationwide was just incredible. I think as a parent, the first thing you do after you get your head straight that your child has pediatric cancer, you get the U.S. News and World Reports, and you find all the top pediatric cancer hospitals, and you start making phone calls. And then when every one of them, when we called for another opinion, said, you're in very good hands at Nationwide Children's, stay right where you are, we calmed down and settled into it and realized that we had found the best care we could find for her.
Timothy in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Timothy.
Hi, thank you very much. And first time I'm listening to your show. I work out of the Big Brothers Big Sisters building on Dublin Granville Road with the Mentoring Center of Central Ohio. So I get down to Columbus periodically, but I live in Ashland. So I appreciate this topic, and I think that it's wonderful work that the doctor's doing. My son had a disease called aplastic anemia. I don't know if the doctor knows of it. I'm sure he does. Mm-hmm. He seems very knowledgeable. And he got a bone marrow transplant when he was four. He's 18 now, and he has no complications from it. But I just wanted to kind of join the conversation and just say we appreciate, you know, that the dedication and the attention that our doctors gave us. I was in the United States Air Force at the time, and the pediatrician who saw him, you know, he was exhibiting symptoms like bruising and paleness for no particular reason, and she didn't settle for the surface perceptions, and she looked deeper, and we very much appreciated that. So I can echo what Mrs. Decker was saying about thanking the doctors who cared enough to go deeper, if you will.
Well, Timothy, I am so glad for the outcome.
Thank you.
You know, you're always kind of holding your breath. So thanks for sharing that with us, and thanks for sharing your story.
Thank you. It was very, very scary, like Mr. Decker said, when we received the diagnosis, and we're just in shock, like, well, okay, what does this mean? I never heard of this disease, which, like the doctor said, cancers are rare anyway, and although it's not a cancer, it's even more rare than most things. And so we were like, what is this? And so it was very scary. We appreciated the time that the doctors took with us to explain things, and really the Air Force was amazing. They transferred us from New Mexico to San Antonio to Wolford Hall Medical Center, and within days, and really took great care of us. Agencies like the Fisher House and Ronald McDonald House were instrumental. In
the Fisher House is a military
equivalent to Ronald McDonald's
House. Right.
Definitely.
Well, Timothy, thank you for the call, and thanks for listening for the first time.
You're welcome, and thanks for being part of it. And doctors, I can't remember your name, Dr. Sorry
Dr. Rinelli.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Rinelli, yes, thank you for what you do. Deeply, deeply appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, Timothy. You know, there is that thing, the idea that it's not, you're the one getting the diagnosis, you're hearing all about it, Erica, and also Dr. Rinelli, but it's not happening to you. It's such a different dynamic, right, Dr. Rinelli?
Yeah, I would agree. And I think more so, it becomes more into play than on the adult side where you're really having a one-on-one dialogue with an adult who can more or less understand you, advocate for themselves. The situation gets much more complicated when it's a young child and you're trying to articulate a diagnosis, the significance of a diagnosis to that child, as well as the significance to the family. And in addition, throwing the technicality and all of the jargon that they're going to have to learn and hear about and master while they're still trying to overcome the notion that their child suddenly has been diagnosed with a potentially fatal disease. What we find and what we find that we do quite frequently is basically go over things again and again and again and again. I don't know if Lily's mom would comment on that, but I think families sometimes feel embarrassed because they feel like they're asking the same questions over and over again because this is like learning a new language to them many times.
He must have talked to Suzanne Scott, who's our nurse practitioner who I call. During treatment, I called at least once a day, if not two or three, and she was the kindest person I've ever met. She always took my calls and treated me with such respect and such kindness and never came across that I was a bother, even though I knew as I was dialing that it might get her bogged down.
The nurse practitioners, that must be a nice opportunity in this field of medicine, doctor, to have them?
They're a great resource. They're very knowledgeable. Someone like Susan's been doing this for a long time, and when Susan calls me and tells me there's something wrong, I drop what I'm doing because she's generally correct, and she's always correct, actually. They just have a different perspective. I think that nursing perspective is there's a little more emphasis on the softness of medicine, on the patient interaction, and it's a nice playoff of kind of the doctor, kind of bugs and drugs, technical end of things. And I think the nurse practitioners, quite frankly, do a lot to teach us about how we should be interacting with patients, because sometimes we think we're doing the right thing, and they'll pull us aside and say, "Yo, you're not getting it," and we will pretty quickly change our gears and try to get it for them.
Dr. Rinelli, thanks for joining us today.
Sure, you're welcome.
It's Dr. Mark Rinelli. He's a hematology, oncology, bone marrow transplant doctor at Nationwide Children's Hospital. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation with Erica Decker, Lily Decker's mom. Lily Decker is the subject of Misty Crane's two-part story over Sunday and Monday. Misty Crane's a medical reporter at the Columbus Dispatch for the last 11 years. We'd like to hear from you if you want to join the conversation, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, a photo finish in Iowa, cutback plans for the Pentagon, a fire starter arrest in L.A. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point begins this afternoon at 1 o'clock on 89.7 NPR News. Stay right here in 20 minutes, beginning at 11. It's All Sides Weekend with host Marilyn Smith and a discussion of the best food and restaurants in Central Ohio. Join us for All Sides Weekend, beginning at 11 on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from the estate of Donald R. Glancy, whose life was enriched by public radio and television, and whose bequest seeks to encourage others to discover WOSU Public Media.
You can help shorten the 89.7 NPR News winter membership drive. Become a sustaining member right now. For every 100 sustaining members we receive, we will eliminate one day from our membership drive. As a sustaining member, your membership never expires. No more reminders in the mail, and your member card renews annually. But right now, you can take one day off of our upcoming membership drive. Visit WOSU.org and make your sustaining gift today. And thank you for your support. Partly sunny skies throughout the day today and a high of 51 degrees. Clouds tonight, a low of 34. More sunshine for Saturday and a high of 44 degrees. Partly sunny on Sunday and a high of 40. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
We are talking about childhood cancer through the story of Lily Decker, which was depicted in Misty Crane's article. Misty Crane, medical reporter at the Columbus Dispatch. Misty, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, Ann.
And also with us, Lily's mom, Erica Decker. Erica, thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
And still with us, Dr. Rinaldi, who's going to hang on in case there's any questions from any of the listeners out there. Dr. Rinaldi, thanks again. Joining us now is Cindy Lazarus. She's CEO of Flying Horse Farms. It's a permanent year-round camp for children with serious illnesses. We've been talking about it all hour. Welcome to the show, Cindy.
Hi, Ann. Great to be with you.
Tell us, where did Flying Horse Farms – I first started hearing about it maybe about 4 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, when the initial fundraising began and that sort of thing. Where did it come from?
There's a couple who live in Bexley, Jenny and David Balford, who have a healthy family, but had a kind of summer house up near Mount Gilead, Ohio, and did work with Make-A-Wish. At that point, they would do a day on the farm for the families who were involved working with a kid again, I think is the right name now. And they started saying, is there more we could do? And the people from Akitigan suggested that they connect with the Association of Hole-in-the-Wall Camps as the entity in this country and now internationally that really has developed an expertise around providing camping experiences for children with serious medical illnesses. And so David and Jenny have been working on this for the better part of the last 10 years. Now we opened almost exactly a year ago a camp in Ohio for children within our state, from all around our state, as well as adjoining states, where children with serious medical illnesses can have camping experience at no charge to them or their families.
It's located out in Mount Gilead area.
Outside of Mount Gilead, okay. So right off of Interstate 71 and Exit 151.
But kids come from all over the place to go there?
They do. The furthest that we've had was a young girl who whose family brought her up from Alabama. She came for our heart camp. And her mom, I happened to answer the phone the day that her mom called, and she said that her daughter had been wanting to go for a while and that she had said to her, when you're 12, I'll let you go to camp. One of those things that mothers do all over the place. And the daughter remembered, and she was 12, and the mom called us, and they drove up. The family stayed with the relatives in Cincinnati while the daughter was with us for a week for our very first heart camp.
So you have different camps that are specialty camps. Then you also have one big camp where all kinds of kids with all kinds of illnesses come to?
Well, we do family camp weekends in the spring and the fall because the children are already missing enough school. We don't want to cause them to miss any more school. And that's actually how we met Lily and Erica and their family. They came to one of our family camps. And those last spring were just kind of, any condition that was within the groups of medical conditions that we work with. And then in the summer, when we have residential camps that are just for the kids, we do it by specialty so that we can have doctors like Dr. Rinaldi who will be on camp, on site, to provide the support that we need to make sure that we can serve these children safely.
Misty Crane, you said that it was actually Flying Horse Farms that first inspired you to the Lily Decker story. What did you make of Flying Horse Farms?
Oh, it's just fantastic. I mean, any kid would love to go there. But I was most impressed by how they're able to support these children without making it about the illness. You know, it's kind of behind the scenes that they're ready for the worst, but the kids aren't talking about cancer or sickle cell disease while they're there. They're painting and doing archery and fishing and having a great time. And when we first got there, I think we expected it to be more profound, that we were going to be around all of these sick children. And Chris and I, the first night, said to each other, it's crazy. It's like we're just at camp with kids having a blast.
You mean you got to stay overnight?
Yeah.
Oh, lucky.
We get to go to bonfire and everything.
I would think that, you know, you think you're going to imagine that the kids are going to get there and they're going to kind of say, like, well, what are you in for? But they don't.
That's what I expected, too. I mean, there was a moment the first day where one of Lily's co-campers said, do you have sickle cell or cancer? And I didn't put this in the story, but I'll say it now. Lily said, I have breast cancer. And then she said, wait, no, brain cancer. And that was it. They didn't talk about it anymore at all after that. So it's pretty funny.
Why is it important to have why can't, you know, if kids are healthy enough to go to the camp, why can't they go to any camp at that point?
Because they need the medical support to be kind of on site and present if a situation develops. And also because those medical personnel help us to plan what the camp is going to consist of safely. So when we did our heart camp, we had a third of the kids who came were heart transplant recipients, which still just takes my breath away to think about that with a single child, much less, you know, like all of these little people running around. And it happened to be the week of the heat wave. And so you take this incredibly medically fragile population and add something that is a real challenge in terms of their medical care. And it was the medical personnel who kind of, you know, immediately, first of all, looked at the camp that we had planned and said, with this group, you need to have more rest periods. And then as the heat wave developed, they started saying, we're shutting down archery, we're doing this, we're doing that, we're having camp-wide swims. And, I mean, it made it possible for us to serve that very medically fragile population for a week during the worst heat wave we've seen in a long time, and not a single child was seen in our medical unit for heat-related or heart-related problems of any kind.
Dr. Rinaldi, this kind of treatment, having fun, how important is that to the kind of treatment you give the children?
I think it's an indispensable part of their whole illness experience. It's basically an introduction into being a kid again and to seeing other kids, other children that are going through exactly what you're going through, who are experiencing the same sorts of problems, things that you can relate to, but children that are also having fun and getting back to the business of being children. You know, I would encourage any family listening who has a child with a sort of a qualifying illness, if that's what we can call it, to get in touch with Flying Horse Farms. It's really a phenomenal organization. And quite frankly, the camp's not even done, and you can see what kind of fun the kids have. I can't imagine what it's going to be like when everything is 110% up and running.
Erica Decker, how did you find out about Flying Horse?
Through a friend. Actually, Sharon Cameron sent me an email. I've known Sharon for a long, long time, and she was, I think, one of the early supporters of the camp and had been invited to a weekend or an overnight event at the camp, and she sent me this lovely email, and it was worded in a way that she said, I've just been to the most magical place in the world, and she said that she could picture Lily doing all of those things, and I wasn't aware of the camp. But to be honest, I think I had my head in the sand quite a bit about that. I think I was more worried about Lily seeing other sick children and her kind of adding it all up and asking more questions about her future. Mm-hmm. But as Misty said, I was completely off base. So we went, and I was more nervous than anyone. You know, you try to protect them from the truth sometimes in a little bit. I just didn't want her to read ahead. But we got there, and Lily lit up, and she smiled again, real smiles, not the I'm really happy mommy smile, the really silly, fun, I hadn't seen it in years smile.
Yeah, you know, that idea that they're going to see other kids who are sick, it's counterintuitive. It doesn't bother them, right, Cindy? Were you surprised? What did you make of it?
Well, I think because, as Misty said, when they're there, they're not sick kids, they're kids.
Right.
And so there is that sense of, I'm not the only person here who's lost my hair. I'm not the only person here with a zipper scar on my chest. I mean, So there is a they are then, you know, kind of the new norm. But really, I think it is they just kick into being kids. And that's our job. You know, we have the wonderful medical staff that makes it possible for us to do this. But our job is to, you know, kind of jumpstart them into being goofy kids as quickly as we can. And we do that by being goofy adults. And I mean, you have to have the right group of people who are willing to kind of put it out there to make it possible for these kids in the short period of time that we have to really kind of immediately engage in fun and feeling that sense of possibility in their life again.
This must be really expensive. And I know most kids who are seriously ill, their parents don't have a lot of, you know, pin money left over. How is it paid for?
It's all through private donations. These camps were started by Paul Newman with the original camp in Connecticut. And one of the things that, again, here's a guy who had no need to be involved in this and could have, you know, looked at it from a very kind of secure financial position and had just those intuitive insights that these families are facing enough challenge. And the last thing they need to do is to think about, can I afford for my child to have this experience? Do I take away from my other children in order to make this happen? I mean, all those kinds of questions. And so, you know, kind of his founding principle was no charge at any time to any of the families. And that means that each of the camps individually are responsible for going out and raising the operating money every single year. And we do that through donations, large and small.
What's the magic to being associated with the hole in the wall camps? I know Flying Horse Farms, is it still a provisional member?
We are. They're voting in 2 weeks.
So is it like a popularity contest? Or what are you going to do? Do they just like you? Or?
If it were that easy.
Yeah, exactly. What...
It's a very rigorous multi-year process that if you want to have a camp that would be considered part of the Association of Hole in the Wall Camps, you have to apply and you go through different stages. The day that we opened our camp for families for the first time, which was last November, they had a site team present with a list of about 300 criteria to see whether we were providing the kind of camp experience that was safe and of the quality of excellence that they demand. So it is this kind of process to be accepted as a full member, and that's where we are. And once you become even part of, as we are now, a provisional member, there is enormous resources available to us in terms of learning from other camps' experiences, connecting us with other specialists. So we don't have to invent every piece of a new camp just kind of on our own.
What qualifies a child for the camp, not just in terms of the illness itself, but how do you know when they're well enough to go to the camp?
That's a medical decision. And so, you know, many families like Erica and Lily and James and their other children learned about the camp through friends. But frequently we would get a referral from a medical institution or a doctor's practice. In any event, before a child is accepted, they have to provide their medical records, and we have to have indications from the doctors that they think it's safe. And in order for it to be safe, these are the supports that we need to provide. Almost every child that comes to Flying Horses on medication, and a number of them also have regular treatments that they need to continue while they're at camp. And so it really is a medical question for the treating physician.
Cindy Lazarus, what have you learned as CEO of Flying Horse Farms from the, as Patty says in a Facebook message, what have you learned from your work with these wise beyond their years young ones?
I think one of the biggest lessons that I've taken away from them is the kind of limitless value in the kind of the life in a moment. Because what we see is with the families and with the children that we get to have at camp, these were people who, like all of the rest of us, thought we knew what was going to be happening with their lives. You know, when Franny was born, you worried during your whole pregnancy, and then you have a healthy baby, and you think, okay, you know, we're golden now. And so these are families and children whose path has been changed. And it is just kind of beyond words to capture what you see through them in terms of their ability to kind of redefine and find those moments of joy and meaning and possibility and beauty. I'm in awe of the children and the families that we work with.
Cindy Lazarus, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Cindy Lazarus, CEO of Flying Horse Farms, and also CEO and president of the YWCA before that, 10 years as a judge on the 10th District Court of Appeals, and a member of Columbus City Council, the second woman in Columbus history to serve as a city council president. I didn't mention all that at the outset. Dr. Rinaldi, I was wondering, you must have gone to school for a gazillion years to get all of that specialty under your belt, but what have you learned?
I think you learn how ennobling children can be and how much of an honor it is to work with them, how resilient they are. You know, we have our day-to-day problems and issues and aches and pains, but it doesn't compare to a child who is going through something that no child needs to go through and may have sequelae that last for years and years and years afterward. It puts things in perspective, and every day when you come to work, it's sort of a re-education and a reintroduction to what's really important and what is really not important.
Well, thank you again for joining us today, Dr. Rinaldi.
Thank you.
And Misty Crane, I know you've been writing about these kinds of things for 11 years, but do you too learn something new every time?
I do, for sure. In this case, I learned a lot from Lily, but also from her parents. I mean, to be able to get up every day and just say, let's have fun, let's do this thing, let's have a great life, and we'll deal with the obstacles as they come. I told countless people about them. I was like, this kid is fantastic, but you got to meet her parents.
She's somebody's progeny. Erica Decker, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it. Erica Decker, mother of Lily Decker, subject of Beautiful Stories, Mr. Crane's medical reporter at the Columbus Dispatch. And thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. On the next Fresh Air, we remember singer Barbara Lee. She died last week at the age of 82. We'll listen to her 1991 Fresh Air concert of Cole Porter songs. Also, an interview with Tina Fey. Her book Bossy Pants just came out in paperback. Join us. Come shine.
And Fresh Air begins later today at noon. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus. And streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media. Be sure to watch Columbus On the Record. It's tonight at 8:30 on WOSU-TV. News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson and his panel discuss the GOP race for president, President Obama's controversial appointment of Richard Cordray as the nation's consumer financial watchdog, the link between drilling and earthquakes, and more. Tune in for Columbus On the Record. It's tonight at 8:30 on WOSU-TV.
Start your day with local updates from the award-winning WOSU News team.
At last count, Columbus City Attorney Richard Pfeiffer identified 6,117 vacant houses in the city, but that number has increased by more than 30% since 2006.
Private capital has literally walked away from those neighborhoods.
Hear the latest in local and national news on Morning Edition on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station.
And it's 46 degrees with some sunshine in downtown Columbus. Sunny skies today, warming up to an unseasonable high of 52 degrees. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 34. Mostly sunny again for Saturday, a high of 44 degrees. And expect some sunshine looking ahead to Sunday, a high of 40. This is 89.7 NPR News, and it's 11 o'clock.
Hi, I'm Marilyn Smith. After news from NPR, it's All Sides Weekend. today, a restaurant year in review, what's in, what's not, the effort to make Columbus restaurants zero waste, and of course, the best places to go for good food. Just a few of the topics we'll be talking about with WOSU restaurant reviewers, the Riches Terapak, father and son, and Steve Stover, contributing writer to Edible Columbus. There's also a place for you at the table, no reservations required. It's All Sides Weekend on 89.7 NPR News, streaming on the web at WOSU.org. News from NPR is next.